is And the Next Thing You Know. It's a podcast about how our lives go exactly not as we planned them. Relentlessly so. I'm Susie Sherman. Not gonna lie, it's been a real long time since we've talked, or since I've talked to you, one-way conversation that this is, from the podcasting studio, which is a different podcasting studio since the last time I talked to you because I moved again. Those of you keeping track might remember that since starting the podcast in 2019, I moved from Oakland to Berkeley, then back to Oakland, then moved all the way up to Portland, Oregon, and now I'm living in still another place in Portland. And to be frank, I'll be moving yet again before the next time we talk, or the next time I talk to you, because, dear listeners, shout it so the folks in the back can hear it. Our lives go exactly not as we planned them. I'll introduce today's guest in a sec, but did you know there's a Patreon for the show? When I don't post episodes for months on end, I won't charge your account, but you can support me at patreon.com/nextthingpod. Each month I release an episode, and don't worry, I'll keep track of all that. You could just set it and forget it. It takes a lot of time to produce every episode of the podcast. I'm totally independent here. I do all the research, interviews, editing, copywriting, keeping the audience engaged, promoting the show, all the things. Your support keeps me going. $10 patrons get a shout out at the end of every episode, and there are some fun goodies you get when you become a patron even at the $5 level. Click over to the Patreon page at patreon.com/nextthingpod and sign up. My guest today is the wonderful Shauna Virago. Shauna's done so many cool things in the world, and our conversation just covers a tiny sliver. Shauna is a singer-songwriter and performer who blends old-school country and punk in the most timeless way. Shauna's also the artistic director of the San Francisco Transgender Film Festival and operations manager at Fresh Meat Productions, home of a vast array of trans and gender nonconforming arts and performances. In this conversation, we talk mainly about Shauna's work and influences coming up as a musician, Shauna's move to San Francisco from LA, grassroots political work, and a bit of Shauna's love story, meeting longtime partner and fellow creative and political conspirator, the choreographer and Fresh Meat artistic director, Sean Dorsey. Shauna is just straight up cool, and it was so fun to talk and learn from Shauna's deep cultural knowledge about music and trans and queer history. As a special bonus for this episode, I'm really excited about this. I put together a Spotify playlist of artists Shauna and I referred to in the episode, along with two of Shauna's original songs. You can find the link in the show notes in your podcast app, or go to the website at nextthingpodcast.com and click on the episode link. Without further ado, and thanks for tuning back in with me, this is my conversation with Shauna Virago. I was wrong about my assessment of the story that we're going to tell.
Okay.
I think your wonderful love with Sean is going to definitely be a big part of the story.
I don't know.
Great. You know, it's all whatever comes through.
Fantastic. Well, it is true that meeting Sean Dorsey was something I had not anticipated happening. And just the sort of deep gratitude I have for meeting him and our relationship. I didn't really think I'd ever be in a long-term relationship with somebody, and especially somebody as great and smart and compassionate and playful and all cool and really good person. So I didn't see that coming. So
it's amazing. And it took a long time to get to that moment where you met and were able to receive each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For me, one of the things I've mentioned before is this idea of expectations that maybe people had 20, 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago of what you were worth having, whether it was a job or sane friends or, you know, or dating partners.
Yeah.
So I feel very lucky, and also lucky because one of the things, I was a queer domestic violence counselor for a long time. And so I just kept seeing people's, I don't know, sadness and what they were going through and how we're not taught how to do healthy relationships, whether you're a cis straight person or queers, you know, it's something, healthy relationships, healthy emotions, how to balance your checking in your savings account, just the basics, like we don't get those. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like doing the domestic violence work also allowed me to question what's a healthy relationship, what would that look like? So that kind of set the ground, I think, mm-hmm. to know what a healthy relationship did not look like. I saw like almost every day at the time on my job. So that was also became a blessing to kind of educate me on what one would look like. So, mm-hmm.
yeah. And what situation did you and everyone, does everyone truly deserve? And what exactly this does not look like helps to inform.
Absolutely.
Your sense of what you deserved. Yeah.
Yeah.
When were you working at the domestic violence clinic?
So I worked at an agency called Community United Against Violence.
CUAV, yeah.
CUAV. I got hired in the very beginning of 1997. And I left in the beginning of 2010. And I was the first trans spectrum woman they hired at the time. So, yeah, I felt like I got hired at a Fortune 500 company. I had a regular paycheck and I had health care. So it was pretty amazing.
It was a big score.
Huge.
Had they started like in the 80s or so? Or do I have the timeline on that right?
They technically started in the 70s after the White Knight riots, mm-hmm. and then ended up doing domestic violence work and hate violence work in the 80s, I think. Mm-hmm. I think they organized a lot of street patrols prior to that.
Yep. Yep, yep.
Yeah.
Well, and so in the very late 90s, top of 1997, you were the first trans woman that they hired.
Yeah.
There was such a bifurcation, of course, in the whole queer community. We talked about this a little bit with folks who were LGB, nominally embracing trans folks, but not actually.
Absolutely.
And so that's part of that whole, even grassroots progressive organizations not having it together to be inclusive until the late 90s. This is a really fertile moment that we're talking about the late 90s and the early 2000s.
Absolutely.
Transformational in your personal world as well.
It's funny. I have some friends through the 90s who tried to start some sort of web project about how great all of us were in the 90s. And I mean, it is, there's a lot of really wonderful things happening, but I think we also, some of the organizers may be overlooked. There were people even before us who were doing amazing things.
Yes.
So the people now who to me are young and doing great stuff, there's going to be 20 years from now, people thinking the stuff they're doing is so amazing. And it's like, wait, look back 20 years before, you know, and keep going. So
right.
It is a weird one with the trans piece and how I think a lot of people in the LGB world really wanted nothing to do with trans people. Like trans people had mental illnesses or weren't really part of their struggles. And it's curious how all of us, but I would say these folks in the LGB world really didn't embrace trans people who I think, as we know, owe so much to, especially trans women of color in the 60s and 70s, sort of changing, I think, the trajectory in a big way.
Yes.
And just no awareness of that.
Right. It's really only just started that there's much increased awareness about Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera and they identified themselves in a really different way because it was a really different time as well. But acknowledging, I don't even think people much younger than me, I'm pushing 50. I don't know that even people much younger than me, like ever read Leslie Feinberg, for example, right? Like, so you're right, like 20 years from now, the whole new culture really of acknowledging trans spectrum, gender fluidity, mm-hmm. non-binary identities, this is a whole like new vanguard, but all of the work that you've done and all of the work folks previously did, I mean, we're, as they say, we stand on the shoulders of giants in every generation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So tell me about, we're going to go back in history a little bit more.
Okay.
Tell me about your life as a musician when you were young. What was going on for you when you started rocking?
Well, I started playing the guitar in the 70s when I was about 14 years old. And our kitty just came in.
Kitty knows how to open the door. I heard it.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Are you okay? Sean is in the next room with his dancers. And they're doing like a dance warm up. So usually he would like to hang out with Sean right now, but he has to hang out with me.
He needs some comfort. Right? Is there a way, Shauna, that you can close that door? Because I am hearing Sean
sure.
In the background.
1 second. Thanks. Let's go this way, buddy. I'm so sorry. There we go. That is not a sound effect. That's a
totally,
real one.
Totally.
So, I mean, I always wanted to, from a really early age, play guitar and write songs. And I also felt trans from a very early age and thought I'd have to deal with that. And whatever that looked like, I didn't know. Fortunately, when I was, like 8 or 9 years old, I saw Christine Jorgensen on like the Dinah Shore show or something. Mm-hmm. Suddenly I had a roadmap, or I had something to think about as possible.
Sort of a seed that was planted in a way.
Absolutely.
On something that was forming already in you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the music, I always feel like those two things were both happening and important, music and trans. So when I started playing the guitar, I always loved what you might call old rock and roll music. So that would be like Elvis Presley or Chuck Berry or these types of things. And that tied in also with the other music I liked at the time, David Bowie with the Spiders from Mars, T-Rex, and the New York Dolls.
For sure, for sure.
So it all created this aesthetic that I think a lot of people in the United States, 70s punk rock, also had kind of a similar background or aesthetic of music. I mean, not entirely, but I think there's a lot of us that did.
Yes.
You kind of see the rockabilly thing in American punk rock. But I mean, some people, I always thought, and I still think, like the whole arena rock of the 70s was still a very like straight thing. Very straight guy. Mm-hmm. My brother, he had Led Zeppelin in the house. And
of
so,
course.
Yeah. So that wasn't my kind of music. Mm-hmm. And so punk rock happened just about a year after I started playing guitar. And that was just astounding to me. My friend that I hang out with on Zoom on most Saturdays, they're not buying that it was culturally important. They think it's just the romanticism of youth elevating it. And I'm like, it's possible. But I try to point out that that also shaped a lot of cinema and graphic design. There's a lot going on,
yes.
I think. And there was a lot of queers in punk rock. One of the people I saw at that time in probably about 1980 was a fellow named Tom Robinson. Mm-hmm. Who was an out gay man doing punk rock music. So, you know, of course I took myself to see him alone. I couldn't let anyone know I was going to go mm-hmm. see Tom Rock.
So around 1980, you said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but one thing I do think is true in a lot of the music I'm describing, there was a way that, for example, in the 70s, there were rock magazines, like Cream was one of them. And Circus, and these were very snarky magazines, but What was good is they focused a lot on kind of the alternative music of the time. And so through them, I learned about Amanda Lear, a trans woman who was a muse of Salvador Dali. And she's on one of the Roxy Music album covers.
Right. Yep.
You know, and then Bowie, reporting from Berlin, hung out with a trans woman named Romy Hogg, who he dated. Lou Reed,
of course, problematic, you know.
Yeah.
As some of those relationships were, it seems. Yeah.
It's just too bad. Mm-hmm. We would just worship him, probably. Mm-hmm. But he's just a really abusive person, I think. So, but yeah, so there was this kind of parallel world kind of happening. Candy Darling.
Warhol, right. Right.
Warhol, mm-hmm. whole thing. So, mm-hmm. so that was very important to me. It's funny. Sean was talking today about how, to some people, how important Carol Burnett was to him as a kid. And he had to explain who she was. Mm-hmm. And of course, that happens to all of us, where people just have new, like, sets of references.
Yes.
And I don't even know, believe me, I'm not really up to date with all the things that are happening now. I live in kind of a bubble, you know. I'd still, the music I love the most is this kind of music.
I think a lot of people experience exactly that, where the music that was most impactful was really what we started listening to as teenagers and into our 20s. And it makes an imprint.
It really does. I mean, I think probably a neurological kind of superhighway of some kind.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. So. You happen to be coming of age at a really potent time for this amalgam of roots rock and punk that was going on.
Very lucky. And also, this was on the West Coast. And so there was a club called the Palomino Club in North Hollywood that I could go see people like Screaming Jay Hawkins play at. So I also made a point of seeing all of these people because I love that music so much. And there was a way to see them, like Bo Diddley or Chuck Berry or John Lee Hooker, mm-hmm. or Jerry Lee Lewis or Johnny Cash. So I think, you know, one of the things that I think is true about a lot of, for let's say 20 years, people have been concerned about reading with young people. But I feel like there's actually a lot of reading and writing that does go on, even if it's texting. I feel that what I went through and being able to go see these artists, you know, that was not part of any school curriculum.
Yes.
Right? And I feel like as long as young people are interested in something, their curiosity will keep, they'll keep finding cool things and they'll be fine. It might not be that, you know, does every generation have to read Moby Dick?
So you're coming of age and formulating your transness at the same time that you're becoming a musician. You start to play out in the late 80s, it sounds like.
I actually started to play out like house parties in the late 70s.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't realize. So you're really young when you start to actually play.
I was really young.
Okay.
Yeah. And then... and then started to play clubs in the early 80s and sometimes dances or even frat parties. That was, they paid the best, but it was actually getting out of those parties on a couple of occasions. Definitely. They just wanted to kick my ass only because I was visibly in their minds, a faggot. Mm-hmm. So that was also bizarre. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to make it as a surviving musician from like 18 or 19. Yeah, so I'm a product of my time. So that also meant I feel very lucky that my vocabulary of being a musician also being forced to learn a lot of different types of music. And I think a lot of people don't go through just playing house parties and dances and things like that. So that was also a good education.
Mm-hmm.
Getting into the actual clubs in Hollywood and other places,
right,
was great.
Right.
Yeah.
Developing your chops, starting to play in, original music kind of from the get-go, or were you doing covers at first at those house parties, or?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Both. And for some reason, and I think I mentioned this before, but this was in Los Angeles. And so you had Hollywood. That was kind of the mecca for a lot of stuff, obviously, in punk rock music. But then all throughout Los Angeles County, there was a really vibrant sort of like house party scene for young people. And for some reason, people wanted to hear a lot of early rock and roll at that time. There were some things that were cool, like Bowie, to play some Bowie songs was great, but also to break out anything by the Supremes or Johnny Cash or Eddie Cochran was actually very much a part of what was also kind of going on.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if that house party scene that you're talking about in LA was some of what gave rise to that 70s revival of the 50s in the popular consciousness, i.e. American Graffiti and Happy Days. And I wonder if there was a relationship there between what was going on sort of at a grassroots level and then what came into the consciousness of, you know, like George Lucas, who made American Graffiti, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
quite cool.
You know, it was a product of his coming up and being identified with that music when he was young, I'm assuming. So it's kind of part of that.
Well, I mean, so like my great grandmother, they were Okies. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up, part of my childhood was living with them. And so I knew of Bakersfield music.
Yes.
And I think Mike Ness of Social Distortion, who's also about the same age as me, and also very similar experiences. There was a club called the Starwood in Hollywood. And that's where a lot of punk rock shows were happening in the late 70s. I saw the Buzzcocks there.
Awesome.
In 1979. And that was the first time I ever saw slam dancing. There was no slam dancing at first. It was, you would just kind of hop and jump up and down in place.
Like pogo more. Yeah.
That's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there's a way that, well, I'm jumping around a little bit. But then a few years later, I had a truck driving job for a warehouse. And I would go all over like 100-mile radius from Los Angeles. And I would go into these hubs, these warehouses, and there'd be these guys in there that were old rockabilly guys, you know? And so they were probably like 50, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like 23. And I think they were out there doing their thing still. And I think there's a way that country music and some of this 50s rock and roll never died for some people. And I think, like, I have an uncle who's a rock and roll guy. And so I grew up with that.
Yep.
I grew up with kind of almost like a hierarchy of what's good and what's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of in the classic record nerd way, which mm-hmm. my uncle was. So he would let me know things like, you know, there's other things going on in the 60s besides the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, really? He's like, yes, the Seeds. Or the Count Five, or Question Mark and the Mysterians. That's mm-hmm. the 60s, or the Velvet Underground. So, yeah, I do think that on the West Coast, there was a way that this thing never went away. Probably a lot of us grew up with this certain kind of appreciation. Like, I will say this, like, I've noticed with New York, East Coast people of a certain age, they have much more of an awareness and appreciation for things like what they called girl groups. Like the Chiffons
mm-hmm.
or
Martha and the Vandellas. And is that right?
Yeah. And also doo-wop music.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I think really was the East Coast thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that is why the New York Dolls sound, that to me is what they're really listening to. Mm-hmm. They were listening to that kind of music. Out in the West Coast, I mean, only X could not have happened in New York. Mm-hmm. There's no way.
Yeah.
Or the Ramones.
Right.
All these girl groups that they loved.
Totally.
So.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's that real, yeah, that real sort of, I mean, the Ramones certainly have that rockabilly stuff going on as well, right? Like,
absolutely.
Those quick, almost jangly, you know, progressions and stuff. Totally. But yeah, absolutely, like 60s group. I actually like just flashed onto Sha Na Na for a moment as well, which is really funny. That dates us. But yeah.
With right. their weekly TV show, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
When, you know, it's funny. I'm going to have to go check them out after this. Uh-huh. What's their story?
I think when you said doo-wop influence, I was like, okay, yeah, like Sha Na Na was doing that. And they became sort of a parody of music in a sense because they were so broadly popular because they were on TV. But they also played the house band in Greece, you know, at the dance, right?
Okay.
So they were very much immersed in that very self-aware, we are bringing the 50s and 60s back into this moment in the late 70s, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when did you move to San Francisco, Shauna?
I moved to San Francisco, I guess 1991.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're gigging out from when you're very young, you're in house parties and clubs in LA, and your formulation for yourself, for your gender identity is happening in this co-evolving process with, mm-hmm. with developing your music aesthetic and playing out. And you're not, I think when I said where you started playing publicly in the 80s, I was mistaken there. It's the late 80s that you're really coming out as trans and making that transition from like being perceived by frat boys as a feminine man in their eyes.
Yeah.
And making the transition by the late 80s of actually living as trans.
Yeah. It's interesting because I would say at that time, most of us felt so alone. It wasn't an easily accessible roadmap to find other people like you or to get hormones, things like this.
Yes.
And so I met a couple people. I had another person I knew. We both worked at the same warehouse who was coming out at the same time I was, who passed away of AIDS really not long after that, I would say. And, that was just unheard of to have two of us end up there as trans-identified people. Mm-hmm. Like my boss was at work, a closeted gay guy, sort of a military fetishist guy. Mm-hmm. So I knew him before I got hired, and he hired people he perceived as sort of like, I always joke, like fake rough trade. Mm. Sort of looked a little punky or maybe with comb back hair and leather jackets and stuff. Very, almost like Kenneth Anger, Scorpio Rising sort of boys. And we were his truck drivers and he was the boss of the warehouse. Mm. So if we had both been gay identified when we met, that would have made a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. We had tried to make life make sense in gay environments. That was one of the places that you would end up at parties and bars and things.
Right. That's a really good way to put it.
Yeah.
I appreciate thinking about it in that frame. Yeah.
There wasn't really a lot of places to go. You know, there was a bar in Los Angeles called the Queen Mary, and that anybody kind of breaking gender rules maybe could end up there. That was the only thing people had in common. So like, years ago here in San Francisco, there used to be an organization called TGSF, Transgender San Francisco. When I moved here, they were called ETVC, Emergency Transvestite Channel. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, oh, you should go to their meeting, their monthly meeting. So I went to this bar called Eichelberger's Bar, that is where a previous generation of drag queens went. Many of them passed on because of AIDS. Mm-hmm. That's where I saw Justin Vivian Bond perform, I think, the second show they did of their Kiki and Herb thing. Mm-hmm. Right. So, but I used to see them in bars too.
Early 90s.
Yeah, this would have been early and mid 90s. Mm-hmm. And I went to this meeting and they were all very done up. Maybe even one or two Dallas Cowboy cheerleader inspired outfits. And I just showed up in a t-shirt and jeans, and I think I had steel-toed boots on and stuff. So, and I was probably the only one really living, as they would say, 24/7 as a trans person. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely a culture clash, you know. They couldn't believe I I went through the world dressed this way. Mm. Like a waste to not femme out and to,
Can I hold that with you for a second? Did someone literally say it was a waste to you?
It was implied, like...
That's the vibe.
Wondering how come I dress like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a little more eyeliner and I could be in the club, things like this.
Yeah, yeah. So living as a trans woman and not having the aesthetic that's very high femme in the way that drag performers are doing.
Right.
As part of their performance.
Absolutely.
Right. Not understanding that, oh, this is another way to be.
Right.
Like, why would you waste your femininity? Is that exactly kind of what you're saying? Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I was younger than them, you know. I was also younger than them. And I think my universe was different than theirs was. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of them probably got up and went to work as like people who are perceived as cis males.
Yes. Yeah. Most of them.
And because of the jobs I had, I'm lifting boxes or doing semi-physical jobs still. So, you know, anyway, and I'm a punk, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. so it's mm-hmm. funny. That's been another thing, you know, with certain trans women over the years asking me why I dress this way. And, you know, I'm like, I don't know. I have my worker shirt on. Mm-hmm. And I'm a worker, so fuck it.
Yes.
It's really weird how we police ourselves. So mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it feels each of us has our own history and our trials that we've survived. And it's true for everybody. I think the 90s was a really particular era of queerness. Looking back, I think we might have thought, oh, wow, we're really doing something new. Possibly. But it's kind of like when you look at the 50s and you see everyone and they're thinking, yeah, this is amazing. We're making a new path for humanity. And it's like, well, you're going to have to get better hair products first. Like your hair products suck and you don't look so good. And I think of us in the 90s that way a little bit. Like we're rough in the corners. That was a thing in the early 90s was this idea of this disparagement of the word transvestite. Mm-hmm. You know, it was woe to anyone who identified that way. Like you probably couldn't leave your apartment because mm-hmm. you would just be the object of ridicule because you were but a transvestite and not a transsexual. Mm-hmm. And then years later, one of those 101 trainings I was doing and saying, what are the words? Who goes under the umbrella of transgender, the spectrum? Who are the communities? And people threw names at me. And I said, what about transsexual? And it's like, oh, no, no one uses that word anymore. So.
And there's this then new cultural stigma about it. Not acknowledging that there are still people who refer to themselves as transsexual.
Yeah, there are.
And then there's often these divides in consciousness around, well, transsexual necessarily means that someone has had gender-affirming surgery.
Right.
And those kinds of distinctions are sort of like backronyms in a way. It's like you're actually, like, you're trying to explain a phenomenon, like, after the phenomenon happened, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, why isn't there more? This is always something that really strikes me. Like, we've all hopefully been working for sexual liberation, and it means that people get to be self-determined in the way they identify. Why are you going to fuck with someone who's using a word that you don't use? Let's let people be self-determined about how they identify.
I agree with you 110%.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a generational thing in a way. I think younger folks really don't get that there's this whole world of experience. And as you said, really individual experience that people bring
yeah.
to their lives and the culture that's valid and happened before them.
Yeah.
So this is kind of one pivotal moment of time where things are changing. We're talking, you know, early to mid 90s. You're already out. You've made a transition from LA to San Francisco. What brought you to the city?
I had already been to San Francisco just to check things out in the 80s, you know, come up here and spend a weekend, things like that. And I thought it just felt where I could build a life easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had the reputation as a place for queers to come and you would be treated better than most places. And Los Angeles is so big and spread out, you had to get anywhere driving in a car. And I just thought, you know, I just want to live somewhere where I can take public transportation. And I already knew some places here that were trans-centric places, like the Motherlode Bar.
Where was Motherlode?
Motherlode was on Polk.
Mm-hmm.
Polk and Post, somewhere like that. It was the people who owned Diva's Bar, which was just up the street, owned the Motherlode first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that had been around for a few years at that point. It was very small. It was a place to just go and be. And so a lot of sex work kind of happened, I think, out of that bar.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a store called Foxy Lady on Mission Street. And that closed a few years ago. And that was a place that didn't necessarily cater to trans people. It catered to maybe drag and trans, but also it was a place where all the clothes had sequins on them.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever liked clothes with sequins,
mm-hmm.
that was your store. Anyways, I just was over Los Angeles and ready for a change. And I still like living here. We have our little flat and rent control. Thank God.
Hallelujah. Yeah.
The studio that I've been working at, Different Fur, people walk by, don't even know it's there. It was right next door to the Lexington Bar. And most people have no idea. It's like, it started in the late 1960s. Stevie Wonder recorded there.
No kidding.
Herbie Hancock recorded there. It's very cool. The studio board, it's not from the 60s, but it's from the 80s. So when I leave there, I usually leave around 6 p.m. and I walk through that part of the Mission, and it's just still gets me so angry and sad. There's just mostly cis white people and they're all there and it's like happy hour. They're not wearing their fucking masks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe if you make enough money in the tech industry, there's some kind of immunity you get. It's so despite being filled with so much anger about the displacement that's happened, I still like living here.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's still enough of us here.
San Francisco definitely still has its very particular weirdnesses and queernesses that are stable.
I think so. And those of us who remain, basically, I think, have older landlords.
Yes.
That's kind of why we're still here, probably. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Getting toward the late 90s, I know that you're making your home here and there's a lot more trans and queer community here that you're finding, thankfully.
Yeah.
And also, as a trans woman out on the street and as a trans performer, there's a lot of struggle that's still happening. There's more trans community. There's certainly more queer community at this point. But you're still experiencing harassment at clubs. You got bashed during this time.
Yeah.
What's going on in your life at this time?
Well, I mean, I think one of the common sound bites that I think a lot of, I will say a lot of trans women of a certain coming out era. What's interesting about being trans is somebody could be 55 and they're just coming out now, mm-hmm. right? So they might be the same age as me, but their experience is going to be very different as far as this idea of trying to go out only at night as much as you can. So going out at night was definitely, I think, a very common way of existing in the world for, mm-hmm. I mean, for a long time. You know, like, I don't know if I'd still like this book, but I did like Last Exit to Brooklyn, mm-hmm. Hubert Selby Jr. So I think like that book, Jean Genet, Our Lady of the Flowers, you know, also trying to find some lineage, just now those were part of it. And I think like, so Hubert Selby Jr. writing about trans, let's say, spectrum women also who had were junkies in New York in the 50s. And I think, but their world was very nocturnal also. Mm-hmm. And I think that was still very true for me and for people I know, you know? And so I think things did start, I mean, I was really interesting when I started to meet these younger trans people really in the late 90s. And a lot of them had just come, they just graduated college and they had taken women's studies classes. They definitely seemed to have a better education of a lot of trans or gender things than I did, for sure. You know, like they probably had even read Moby Dick, right? And also knew...
but also probably Kate Bornstein and
Kate Bornstein
stuff by that by yeah. that time, yeah.
And what's her name? Judith Butler, mm-hmm. right? Things mm-hmm. like that. So you were really kind of out in the open. Something also has started then, has kept building. There is this new community that's really didn't exist before then. It really got going in the, like, they call it the aughts, where people who are assigned, regardless of what you were assigned at birth, there's this like community we kind of know as the queer community now. And I think that is pretty still new. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you still had your dyke communities and you had your gay communities. And then you had these trans weirdos that really intersected with people, but it wasn't, you weren't really, I would say, valued. Mm-hmm. Not to mention just being like, so playing in bands and then not knowing what's going to happen in the bar I'm playing or after the show. Am I going to get hassled? What it'll be like going to the van? Mm-hmm. All these kinds of things. So being concerned for my safety, which I still am, I'm sure most of us are.
Yes.
Whenever we leave our places, you know, like when we go to Trader Joe's, it's like, okay. Just, it's always there, I think, still, you know.
Yes.
And now we have the crazy alt-right going after us and they just won't go away. I just, I'm all over the place with this answer, but.
It's okay, Shauna.
Yeah.
I was going to say also, not just the alt-right, not just the extreme right, but we've got cis separatist feminists still who are trans exclusive. And it's like, why, when we so clearly should be allies, are you fucking doing this? You know,
it's, I'm like, we need our numbers. Mm-hmm. We need each other.
Yes.
I don't understand it. I don't get it. It's very, yeah, it's weird. It's very weird. But I think, I don't know. I think in the early aughts, things really shifted.
Yes.
That's what I think.
There's a really big moment in your life in queer trans San Francisco and in your life in 2001.
Yes.
At this point, you were pretty beleaguered by getting a lot of harassment and hassle.
Yeah.
And violence directed at you by the late 90s and 2000. And you were barely even going out at this point, it sounded like. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
I definitely, it just got, where's safety? Who are the safe people? I had a little group of cis gay friends that didn't live too far from me. And probably that's, if I hung out socially, that's where I went, because it was just easier to be around them. There wasn't any strangeness around. I wasn't going to get hurt by them. And there wasn't any of the weird, I don't know, potential for violence. But also, once people knew I was trans, that is when problems started. That would be, what's the reaction going to be? Sometimes they'd apologize, you know, like they didn't know I was trans and like, whatever, you know. Or like, I would get dragged out to like dyke clubs. There was a big club here in the 90s called Club Q. And I would just, my friends would take me there and I'd just hang out at the bar. And then if a woman would come up to me and say something like, I love your hair, you know, or what a wonderful shirt you have on. If I said anything like, thank you, it would just be like, oh, you know, oh my God, who am I talking to? Mm-hmm. So it, like, that got old, not to mention public transportation, harassment from people. And so you have, there's transphobic harassment and violence that happened. And then it's also true that, and we know this, but there's like this weirdness, there's like weird misogyny all attached to it all.
Yes.
And it's very bizarre. I think, again, back to this critical mass, now that we have this extended community, we can talk about this. But there was a long time when you just couldn't talk about it.
Absolutely. And I can own of this time of myself as a cis queer person, meeting trans folks and internally not understanding trans experience at this time in the certainly early mid 90s, where I would come across someone in my community not having known that they were trans, and if they came out to me, I had those reactions, right? I can own that because there was no framework in our discourse about it in the early 90s. It was such a revelation, and I was so wrapped up in my own, wow, I'm queer and this is amazing and stuff, but it was such a cis normative experience and culture that I was in, right? So it took me meeting and becoming close with trans folks to understand trans experience in a more, this is an everyday reality thing, right?
Yeah. And what's interesting about, I think humans, we have a tendency, well, can't believe I'm going to use the name Foucault here. Are we in 1992? Like,
I mean, we have a panopticon right now on our computer screens watching our every move. So
true. It's so true. Yeah. But that book, The Order of Things, and showing this kind of need to classify everything in Western culture. He, I think, starts in the 1600s or something. I'm not sure. 1500s. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always, I think Western culture is, it has to find a place for everything. And I think we don't realize so often, if we've internalized this, how hard it is if we can't find a place for something and learning just to let things be, you know? Mm-hmm. And that can look like different things. Like, there's a fellow in our neighborhood, he must be in his mid-60s, and all he wears are heavy metal t-shirts, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, what, what's his story? Mm-hmm. Like, who is this person? I've seen him for years, you know, and he just walks around, has his, like, Iron Maiden shirt, mm-hmm. or Motorhead or whoever, and I'm trying to place him, and
you're trying to put him in a box in which you can understand.
Yeah. Why can't you just, maybe he hates heavy metal, but he bought, like, they can't give these shirts away now, so he just bought a few.
Right. He went to a thrift store and bought a gross of heavy metal shirts and actually has no connection to heavy metal.
Right. Bought 50 shirts. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think gender and sexual orientation still, right? I mean, it's okay. We're all going to have biases. It's what we do with them.
Yes.
And it's perplexing to me. In America, I think one of the things we don't talk about is this sort of weird radical militant Christianity that came here. And I think immediately just pulled out the muskets and shot people, the first people they saw. I think that happened a lot. I think they just killed people right away and took their land. And I think we still have this, it's just been passed on.
That's right. It's in our cultural DNA.
And it just won't go away. I first saw you in the I-beams mosh pit, throwing elbows and kicking in your steel-toed boots. I moved closer, hoping to catch your sweat.
Yeah. Okay, can I wrangle us back, Shauna, to 2001?
Yes, please do.
I'm going to wrangle us back to the trans art show that happened. Your friend Jordy.
Jordy Jones.
Organized a trans art show in San Francisco in 2001. And it hit you at this moment in your life where you were staying in. You weren't even having your nocturnal life. You were staying in. And Jordy calls you and wants you to perform at this show. And you resisted.
Yeah, I thought, what will I do? What will I wear? Who will like me? I better not do it. Jordy Jones was, in some ways at this time, a very kind of important cultural activist in San Francisco. We both came out about the same time and were friends. And he was kind of a bridge between a lot of communities, especially the sort of, I would say, the fine arts community. People who would show their paintings or some kind of performance art, like whether queer or not, people who would say the art world, the art scene, when they were still like, even if they were cis and straight, they were still kind of like weirdos, you know, like the early Burning Man people. Mm-hmm. And I still have some friends like that I've survived here. So he just took it upon himself with no funding, really. The library was the performance venue. The downtown library. And then he had a couple panels. He had one on trans spirituality, I think was one of the panels. Yeah, there was kind of a meet and greet at what's still called the GLBT Historical Society. I think I met Charlie Anders there. So he put this thing together and he put a performance event together. Trans Art 2001 is May of 2001. And he had a drag queen fashion show as part of it. And then I played music and Sean was in the audience and liked me. And then we met afterwards. There was a small after party at Café du Nord. And Sean showed up there. Yeah, that's where we met. So that was very cool.
And Sean, for the listeners, is Sean Dorsey, Shauna's partner of the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So in this moment, you were resisting even going to this trans art show because shit was so negative at clubs and so fraught for you being out and trans and performing. But this moment was really significant. There's all kinds of big cultural shifts going on in the San Francisco trans community at this time, right? Fresh Meat
happened. I think the first Fresh Meat, I think, was June 2002.
Okay, so it's just after this. The Trans Film Festival was happening from the late 90s.
Started in 1997. I think the 97, 98, and then I think it became every other year. After 99, it became every other year. Yes, because that was another place where Sean and I, that was part of our hooking up too. Because Sean had, he left San Francisco for a couple months after that. So we didn't know we'd hook up again until later in the year, which we did. So there was an event that happened here called Merkinfest. You know, it's a weird thing. So a lot of people never even went to Merkinfest or heard about it, right?
I never heard about it.
It's one of the worst names of all time.
It's hilarious.
You know, So it was at Slim's, the club, and it was basically drag performers, and they got up and they lip synced, but it wasn't necessarily very queer. It was almost like the last vestiges of a certain kind of drag culture that was has died out. And that was in the early 90s.
Early 90s, okay.
Mm-hmm. Jordy then was one of the first trans people to try to be the organizer. And then that made it who it was catered to were people on trans spectrums or gender nonconforming spectrums, right? So that was pretty new still for that to happen. So
to actually, yeah, to have actual gender diversity happening in a drag space.
Yeah.
Right. Because it was so traditionally just cis gay male space. Yeah.
So I think trans art, I don't know. I just was worried. And yeah, it went down well. I played two or three songs. I had a little combo. And thank God I did a good job. And Sean liked my outfit. So thank God I actually wore a dress that day versus not giving a fuck, basically. But yeah, so there was this like young vision of just like cuteness that showed up at the after party. I think he had his like hoodie wrapped around his waist. He had just come from like a dance class or something. He's a dancer and a choreographer. Yeah. And then after we started to connect, first on the phone, we had a lot of landline chats, and then we had a lot of email exchanges. And this went on for probably, you know, I think 5 or 6 weeks before we actually met and had our first real date. And I always feel really grateful that's what we did first, just to kind of get to know each other that way versus hooking up first and then getting to know each other after the fact, which is a story of humanity, I think, really, most of humanity. So
you could be more intentional in getting to know each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
During that time.
We were intentional, and it was also kind of a way to have playfulness versus in our email exchanges. It was also fun. So
talking on the phone, you mean?
Yeah. Just so I feel like that was... because one of the things was nice, Sean was interested in doing a very consciously done relationship. And that kind of was tied in to what I was thinking as well. I think a lot of us, a lot of people, we think our partners are psychic, right? They can guess what we need, what we want.
We have a fantasy that they know exactly what we need without communicating about it.
Yeah.
Expressing our needs is much scarier than just hoping that they know.
Yeah. So I think also... I think we'd both done enough of our own work at also when we met. So it was just a lot of things lined up.
Tell me, Shauna, if you're comfortable, tell me a little bit about what dating and hooking up, finding lovers, finding partners was like for you before you met Sean.
Well, and again, I think it's my, these are my impressions of trans communities at the time. And that largely meant a lot of trans women in dating for trans women. For me, and I think for other trans women, like the idea of anyone really wanting to be involved with you as a legitimate partner just seemed like completely far-fetched. Now, people would want to have sex with you, cis guys, right? But that was basically the extent of it for the most part. So I don't think we even, we didn't even feel entitled to have real partners. This was just hookups with people. They wanted sex. There's also about a lot of validation you felt if a straight guy, cis straight guy wanted to hook up with you. It must... signify that yes, indeed, your experience, he experiences you as a woman, right? So that was, I think that was very important. It's the same thing with, I mean, a lot of cis gay guys. If they can hook up with what they perceive as a straight guy, it's like a coup. It's like the best thing of all. I gotta still put them up here.
Right.
as the ideal man for a lot of people.
Right.
And I knew a couple trans women who had cisgender boyfriends, but they weren't out about it. The men, the guys weren't out about it. So like they never went anywhere. It wasn't like they really ever had dinner or went to the movies or anything, you know. Just horrible, I always thought.
Mm-hmm. It's like some trans women could have relationships, but the catch is that they're on house arrest, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was very, very normal.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of ways that's changed now. But I still know people that I've known for a long time that they're still holding out for that ideal cisgender husband. You know, a lot of fantasy thinking going on. And then I've said this before, but then there would be certain cisgender dyke people who would maybe be interested and want not a relationship, but just hooking up and, you know, having some sex and parties and stuff. But that was usually also the nicer version of what the cis guys really, it was just like they needed their needs met. Whatever that was, they weren't really, they hadn't done their work. I'm like, I'm all for, again, especially cis heterosexual guys who like trans women, I'm like, just get out there. Some of them have now, some of them are part of the struggle. Just come out, you know?
Right. Own it, be it, live it.
You know, we need you too. So, but dykes would be almost embarrassed, I'd say. Like, they'd have let me know, like, oh, I've never kissed a tranny before. Things like this.
So you're speaking to, like, what you've gone through and trans women before you have gone through with coming into a full life, being able to find loving, accepting partners rather than these just hookups and closeted partners. And having come through this life experience in a way that younger folks in trans non-binary community, I think certainly there are folks who still have that struggle, absolutely, because there's always going to be cis sexism, there's always going to be a cis normative culture beating down, but these ways to live life fully are certainly much more possible now for younger folks than they were just even 5 or 10 years ago.
I think so. And it's okay to say that, knowing that that doesn't mean it's still as easy as it should be.
Right. That's right.
We have a long way to go. For example, I was surprised when I started meeting people who came out, maybe that they came out when they were 45 or something, or 50, and maybe they held on to a corporate job that they had. And also never experienced any police violence. I just assumed that was like par for the course. Not in a coming out sense, just like it's just part of being trans, being perceived as a trans woman by police officers, by cops, was like, I think also part of, I would say, continues to be part of our history for some people. A lot of young trans women of color,
especially,
right? A lot of police abuse. And I think most trans people who maybe were experienced as butches, right? Like Leslie Feinberg and that Stone Butch Blues, that great book. And anyone who was perceived to be like breaking these rules around gender expression, I would say that the police were just there. They were just part of our experience. And
that's right.
I think it is true that there are a lot of people now, maybe they're white and have a certain class privilege. They're not going through that. And so sometimes I feel like I will be out. And I think I was thinking, like, you know what? I think I'm a nice person, but I'm not always friendly. And I don't mean to be unfriendly, but there's going to be things that I think you just, you get wary, I think. And so I just think that's maybe what's the result of some of these things have made me just like a little wary, or
having to have your guard up,
and just different humor, guard up, and people who know what I'm talking about. There's fewer and fewer of them. There was a musician who died recently, and we got along sometimes, but she came out before me. Her name was Bambi Lake. And she, a lot of drug addiction, and then some, you know, a lot of unstable housing. And, you know, she was playing out as a trans musician probably in the late 70s, you know, and I think just had a really hard time with the way things changed and the rules changed. She was almost like a living example of, you know, almost like what you would see in a Hubert Selby novel. Like, here is one of the living embodiments of what it meant to be trans. And like, you know, it's just interesting how that person now not being here, even if we didn't always get along, would be at least knowing like, okay, we know this universe still. You know, or like I have a friend who's 75, and when I met her in the 90s, she wanted, her lesson to me was, how good are your street fighting skills? That's what she wanted. She wanted to make sure I had them, you know. That was like her mentorship. And it's also, there's still a lot of jokes and levity, and it wasn't like there was a rain cloud every day, everywhere I went, or, you know, I always thought being trans was cool. I thought, yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad I'm trans. When I was younger, I was like, oh my God, what's happening? What's going to happen? Why me? Why am I trans? Right. But, yeah.
There's things that you found in the culture that you started to identify with and groove with became
absolutely
a gift to you and a way that it shaped you and your consciousness.
And I have I had a lot of respect for these older trans like ladies, you know, that I would learn about, or and I felt very attached to this kind of tradition of them, sort of. I thought they were very special. I still try to keep up with this German trans woman who Bowie hung out with, Romy Hogg or Amanda Lear. I'll check in on them sometimes.
Did you ever connect with Jane County?
I saw Jane County perform in New York 2002. But yes, Jane County. A lot of mad respect for Jane County.
She was really in that punk milieu that you came up with.
Absolutely. So. Derek Jarman made a film called Jubilee. And Adam Ant's in it. And some of those 70s punk figures. That movie would screen by like 1980. There was another documentary of kind of some punk rock performers. And there was like Jane County. I remember seeing them and just going, oh, wow, this is amazing. This person there. So any of these people, I would notice them. And yeah, I was always curious about them. In the early 80s, Andy Warhol would do this tongue-in-cheek yet offensive thing, Girl of the Year, nominate somebody. So he nominated a trans woman named Terry Toy, who I think she's kind of disappeared, maybe moved on with her life. But she was, in the early 80s, I would hear about her as part of that world, you know. And I just always thought these people. So yeah, Bambi Lake, may she rest in peace. Jane County now, thank God they're still around. People like Terry Toy or like Romy Hogg, Mandalier. These are huge. Now, Bambi, I didn't know until I moved here. But yeah, I definitely think what I like about most of these people is I like their toughness. I like that. Like, I like their edge. I like their spine, and like they just kept going. They didn't give up, you know. And I definitely think that these people are so important for a certain like branch of transness.
That people's real lived experience is something we need to be tracking better.
I think so.
Like an ethnography of people's real day-to-day lived experience.
Mm-hmm. You know?
There's so much, it's really good that trans lives are making it into mainstream media, and cis people are coming to understand transness in a new way. But certainly it's been easier and sort of more seductive for mainstream media to focus on the Caitlyn Jenners and the Laverne Coxes, and so it's sort of like there's glamorous,
right,
rich celebrity,
sure,
trans folks. That's transness in the public eye, not really like the kinds of lives that you're talking about. Your life as a scrappy, edgy musician and person who works in skin and bones nonprofit sector.
Sure.
You have a very different life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it is interesting as we are witnessing these things you're describing. And I guess in some ways, what does responsibility mean to make sure that there's other stories being told? So like, yeah, I have to make sure I'm letting people know about these other people too. Like, I have to not just have a big mouth, which I do, but also put out there like, hey, here's some people to be aware of that been doing our thing. Like Marsha P. Johnson, just, you know, just sort of like now, and just the last few years, really, is there mad respect for her?
Right.
And that is a shame, really.
Right. Like when I was in a queer politics class in the early 90s in Santa Cruz, you know, the gay liberation movement that we learned about at that time was, of course, like the really old, you know, the 50s and 60s Mattachine Society,
right,
and Daughters of Bilitis. And that was the history we were getting even into the 90s. And this was, we're still talking about the 50s, but we're talking about the white men, the white cis men in the 50s and the white cis women in the 50s. We're not talking about what's thankfully later being uncovered as a really important part of our history.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I think we just lost an elder here, Felicia Flames. I don't know, she came out in the 60s or 70s. And she was very feisty. Knowing her a little bit, I do think like sometimes it was hard realizing that history or the struggle that maybe she went through, and just it's not really, people aren't curious about it, or they kind of have bypassed that. We're okay with myth making, Stonewall, Compton's, but it's like there were real people there.
Yes.
And some of them, like, it wasn't easy for them ever, and there was no appreciation.
Most of them.
Yeah, and it's not like we, you know, if you were at Compton's or Stonewall and you're still alive, well, hello, we should have a GoFundMe for these people to make sure like they're in comfort. They're, whatever that means, stable housing, healthcare, dental insurance, whatever they need, right? We should make sure that happens.
We're taking care of our elders. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I feel very lucky to, because I don't, the whole thing around celebrity for me is so interesting. You know, I can appreciate the impact it's having on our wider culture. Now, I guess Caitlyn Jenner maybe is a positive thing. I don't really think so.
No.
I don't think they're important. They're important for all the wrong reasons, as like trans people can be assholes too. And as we've been saying, we're just like everybody else.
Yes.
I think one of the blessings I feel is to be able to say that I'm glad I came out when I did. I'm glad I got this like burst of these amazing trans women through basically like rock and roll in the 70s, mostly as really as a young person and learning about them and not knowing a whole lot, but knowing they existed, mm-hmm. knowing Candy Darling existed, or Holly Woodlawn or Jackie mm-hmm. Curtis. They were just like goddesses to me. Just, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I also maybe had an idea of being trans did mean
glamour.
Glamour and with a little bit of an edge to your glamour, mm-hmm. you know, like Jane County had an art show in New York in the last year or so, and it was called Fake Faggots. And it was mm-hmm. like, I think Bowie was one of the paintings and Lou Reed. I think there was one more. I don't know who it was. And I'm mm-hmm. like, yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Like, fuck them for like writing. Who cares? Like, yeah, they dated some people and they wrote some songs. Like, we don't need you anymore. You know? Like, fuck. Especially Lou Reed. God, I'm telling you right now, if there's one person I kind of almost wish, even though I love some of his songs, I just wish I could have gone up to him and honestly just punched him in the face. I know that this is a family show, and I know you don't condone violence. So I acknowledge that. Punching him in the face, of course I meant metaphorically. And in no way.
I don't think you have to qualify. It's okay to have a fantasy about punching someone in the face. It's okay to fantasize about that, especially since the guy's already dead. Don't worry about no qualification necessary. Shauna, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. And let me ask you, is there anything else you wanna touch on?
I think this was good. I think it's true. Like, I didn't anticipate encountering Sean Dorsey. That was just an unbelievable gift from fate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And still, I just very lucky to have a life with this person, and definitely did not think that would ever be possible. You know, like, I was not going out of my way, and he so much just freedom and respect we allow each other is nice. So
mm-hmm. yeah. it's such a potent moment in your life in 2001 when the trans art show happened and you met Sean as a result of that. And then there's this whole cultural opening up of grassroots trans organizations that you both became a part of and generated,
yeah,
that allowed for you a very personal and intimate opening up, but also there's a real cultural shift and cultural momentum around trans culture that's opening up at that same moment. And it's action and organizing and pushing in the culture that's going on before this, but yeah. It's really in the early 2000s that I think, you know, real grassroots trans culture is becoming really potent and visible in queer communities.
Absolutely.
And you both were a big part of that in San Francisco.
Yeah, I think very fortunately, just lucky, you know, that yes, we were and are. And one thing I will say that was part of this mix was the police accountability work also was happening at that time mm-hmm. in a new way, and really exposing the idea of the police causing a lot of hate violence against trans people and mm-hmm. documenting it. That also was part of the late 90s and the early aughts in a new way that hadn't happened before. So I think there was this like opening up of art and still like, okay, finally we're exposing this issue of police abuse. And mm-hmm. I will say, being part of that work in San Francisco, we have these Democratic clubs mm-hmm. and that the people, the gay, lesbian, bisexual at the time, they weren't really interested. They didn't want to dig deep. They thought, no, we have gay cops now. We have lesbian cops now. Like, that's right. All we're talking about.
Like, that's the end all be all of what we're working
We've
for.
We've achieved something. Mm-hmm. I had to do a training with a trans guy, I think in like 1997, for the Harvey Milk Democratic Club, before they would add the T to their name, Harvey Milk LGB Democratic Club. They had to get a training. They had to hear from us why it's important to add the T. Wow. They couldn't just do it, you know? So I think...
It's shockingly late in history for that moment to have occurred in the late 90s.
And so yeah. I think, yes, you're right, that there was this opening up that was going on, that we finally got to start, I don't know, telling our stories, telling our needs, advocating for our rights in a way that was new.
What a joy and an honor to talk to Shauna about Shauna's life and about this specific slice of queer history and rock and roll history. Find Shauna online at shaunavirago.com and buy Shauna's music at shaunavirago.bandcamp.com. I've also posted an extensive reference section for this episode in the show notes, where you can find more about Shauna and about all the cultural touchstones we talked about in our conversation. That's also where you're going to find that link to the Spotify playlist for the episode. Just head over to nextthingpodcast.com. You can become a patron of the show at patreon.com/nextthingpod. I want to thank all my patrons for all the support you give me at any level you're doing it. You help make this show happen, and I appreciate you so much. And as always, a particular shout out goes out to my failure and redemption level patrons: Amy, Barry, Bonnie, Idell, Heather, Jeannie, Jen, Christina, Kurt, Lisa, Mark, and Noah. And to my serendipity level patrons: Brittany, Cindy and Steve, Dorian, Jody, Christy, and Mickarell. Thank you extra special much. Again, the place to sign up to support the show with actual cash money is patreon.com/nextthingpod. That's patreon.com/nextthingpod. We are And the Next Thing You Know. Subscribe in your podcast app and visit us at nextthingpodcast.com, where you'll find the complete transcripts, all the social media links, and really nerdy show notes for every episode. Check it out at nextthingpodcast.com. Shout out your favorite episode on social media with the hashtag nextthingpod. Hashtag nextthingpod. There's two T's in there. Next thing pod. Word of mouth is the best way to increase the visibility of the show. You can also rate or review us at iTunes. That really helps. Email your And the Next Thing You Know story at nextthingpod@gmail.com. That's nextthingpod@gmail.com. We might feature it in a future episode. The musical interludes for this episode were, of course, by Shauna Virago from Shauna's song Eternity Street. The Banana Peel is by Max Runnerschow. Music is by John Schwartz. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk soon, or, you know, soonish.